There are two texts from which these thoughts come, both punchlines to what appear in the New Testament as pretty scary stories. The first one comes after Jesus tells the parable of the rich man whose land brings forth plenty, and he has no place to store the grain that's come forward, so he decides to build bigger barns, and he says, I now have ample resources for the rest of my life. I will take my ease. And the punchline to the story is, fool, this night your soul shall be required of you. And the second story, the parable of the wise and foolish maidens who await the arrival of the bridegroom, and some have brought sufficient oil and some have not, and those leave to buy when their oil fails as the bridegroom is delayed. And of course, while they're gone, he arrives, they shut the door, the foolish cannot get in, and the punchline is, watch therefore, you know not the day nor the hour. We've taken the phrase sudden death and turned it into something fun, as in, they scored a goal at the end of regulation, now it's time for sudden death. In a soccer match, a football game, a golf tournament. And yet, sudden death is a fact of life. Your family knows this intimately this week, but all of us know it, have experienced it, and are aware of it. In some sense, all death is sudden if it occurs with someone we know and love. Even one that's been anticipated or expected, when it happens, everything else stops, and there's a suddenness to that. And we are the only species that know not the day or the hour, but the inevitability that one night our souls will be required of us. Imagine with me, if you will, 3,500 or so people on July 11th, 2001, doing on that day, by and large, what we're doing now. Perhaps getting ready to send a child off to college. Tomorrow I'm visiting with parents of prospective Texas Tech students, and Tuesday giving a presentation to honor students anticipating coming to Texas Tech in the fall. Weddings are being planned. Financial portfolios are being adjusted. We have promises to keep and miles to go before we sleep. And on July 11th, 2001, 3,500 people doing exactly what we're doing now had no idea that they had exactly 2 months to live when the hour of 9 o'clock came on September 11th. Would it have helped to know in advance, do you think? Would it have changed how they lived to know when the hour would be and how soon it would come? It's an interesting question. A journalist working for a newspaper in Ann Arbor, Michigan, ran across a piece of research that was published about a year ago. The title of it was The Procrastination of Enjoyable Experiences. And the upshot of the article was a study that was done that interviewed people who had moved to major cities, London, New York, Chicago, Dallas, and how many of them, they were asked, in the first year had visited a number of landmarks. For people who had moved to a city where there were lots of museums and landmarks, they visited them to a much lesser degree than tourists who came and visited for a week. In other words, if you move to a place where there is the Lincoln Memorial and the Smithsonian, you've got forever to visit it. But if you're only going there for a week, you see many more things. And curiously enough, or not so curiously, it's almost overstating the obvious, that in any of those places where an exhibit or a landmark or some other notable thing was going to close or be moved or in some way be inaccessible, attendance went way up. Once we know that time is short, we pay closer attention to what is available. It's a marketing piece of research, and they have found that gift cards that have long periods of use are less likely to be used than gift cards that expire very soon after they're bought. So companies, of course, sell gift cards that you can use for the next 5 years, because chances are you'll lose them and never use them. But if they're only available for 6 months, we pay attention. Well, it, in some sense, begs the larger question What is the value of each day? Especially in light of not knowing the day or the hour, knowing that it will come, and the possibility that it might come sooner than we think. Well, the author of this newspaper blog, who cited the research, invited his readers to send in ways that they seize the day. What is it that you do in the course of your normal everyday life, small things, big things, ordinary things, that give you a sense of the value of each day? And these are some of the responses that he got, and I want to share those with you. These are ways that people seize the day that may be close to the day and the hour of our last. You never know. Morning workouts and evening walks are very much a part of my life, having added quality to my daily experiences, health, reflection, clarity. Parenthetically, the journalist notes that everyone he asked mentioned exercise. Making a mental list of those things for which I feel gratitude to balance my life view. Connecting with people energizes me, linking me to the past, and at the same time increasing my appreciation of the present moment. Another responded, listening to music touches me on a non-cognitive, emotional level that helps the present moment become more fully alive. Learning new things about the world through reading, listening, and viewing. Setting goals and reflecting about my stage in life helps me overcome inertia and to think about what I want to do. Looking for the humor in everyday events is emotionally helpful and energizing, even at church, presumably. Cooking healthy meals like a pot of vegetable soup is satisfying. Taking a cup of coffee to the patio in warm months and reading the paper. It's a quiet activity, and I like the smell and the ambiance of the outdoors. Keeping my eyes peeled for things that need to be fixed in the house. When I've nailed down another problem, I feel somehow fulfilled. Putting on my gear and my helmet and firing up my motorcycle. Talking with my adult kids just about every day. Falling asleep every night, I think about something in my day that made me feel like the work I do is worthwhile. It's not really a prayer, but has that kind of feeling. Just a recognition of something that affirms my effort. Appreciating nature whenever I have a chance to do so. I go outside and look at the geese that frequently fly over my house. I drive by the lake at every opportunity. 15 or so ways to seize the day. And did you notice that none of them require the early withdrawal of a certificate of deposit? Or readjusting an investment portfolio? Or even taking much out of what's in your wallet? An appreciation each day of the events that make each day unique. This is one way, it seems to me, that we cope with not knowing the day or the hour and living with the inevitability that one night or one day it will be for us. We seize the day in small ways that edify us, that bring us closer, and that heighten our appreciation for the value of each moment. And yet it's still true that these are scary stories. That the day will come, and what then? Children give us a window on this. When a child loses a cat or a dog, they will inevitably say, if they've grown up with church as part of their lives, "Did Fluffy go to heaven?" Ministers sometimes get asked that. You know what they do? They equivocate. They think about a Bible verse or read some theology. Not me. A 6-year-old asked me if Fluffy went to heaven. I'm going to look him in the eye and say yes. What about you and me? What about the people we've loved and lost? Some pastors would equivocate. Some would read theology and try to find a Bible verse that's on point. Not me. Yes, we go too. And we'll meet them there. Sometimes it takes simple poetry to bring out the truth of what we know by our faith, and even by our experience, is what God intends. I've been at this business for 30 years or so, and I've sat with enough people at the moment of their deaths to know that something's happening, that they're experiencing a transcendent moment beyond what I'm experiencing with them. So I believe that Fluffy goes to heaven. I believe we'll see her when we get there. And when we get there, we'll see everybody else that's gone before us. That sentiment is captured by a kind of a poetic essay that's often framed and hung in the offices of veterinarians. This refers to pets, but it's a metaphor that by extension also refers to parents, spouses, friends, children. Just this side of heaven is a place called Rainbow Bridge. When an animal, or by extension anyone, dies that has been especially close to someone here, that being goes to Rainbow Bridge. There are meadows and hills for all of our special friends so they can run and play together. There's plenty of food, water, and sunshine, and our friends are warm and comfortable. All those who've been ill and are old are restored to health and vigor. Those who were hurt or maimed are made whole and strong again, just as we remember them in our dreams and days and times gone by. They're happy and content except for one small thing. They each miss someone very special to them who had to be left behind. They all run and play together, but the day comes when one suddenly stops and looks into the distance, eyes bright and intent. Eager body quivers, and he begins to run from the group, flying over the green grass, legs carrying them faster and faster. You have been spotted. And when you and your friend, or parent, or child, or spouse, when you and they finally meet, you cling together in joyous reunion, never to be parted again. And you look once more into the trusting eyes of the one you loved, so long gone from your life, but never absent from your heart. Then you cross Rainbow Bridge together. We know not the day or the hour. We know that one day or one night, it will be our time. And in the meantime, we seize the day in 100 different ways, but pick 3 today. And we also fear not, for we will cross Rainbow Bridge together. Amen.